So up to this point in the book, we began with Jesus, the revelation of Jesus Christ. And they were introduced to John and to the churches and to God on the throne. And then as we go through the book, when we get to chapter 12, we're introduced to the dragon. And then in chapter 13, we're introduced to the sea beast and then the earth beast, who's later called the false prophet. And then we're introduced to the great harlot. All right. Now, as those evil characters kind of march into this picture before us, they're going to march out in reverse order. So the harlot was the last one we saw come in. She's going to be the first one to go out. And that's what we're looking at in chapter 17 through 18 and even into 19 is the fall of the harlot and her destruction. And then at the end of chapter 19, we'll look at the end of the sea beast and the false prophet. So we started into chapter 18 last time, and we didn't quite get finished. So let's continue with where we left off. So in chapter 18, I think verse 8, we read about Babylon falling in one day. Did this literally happen? No. Not at all. All right. So verse 8 says, therefore her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. So, as we said before, this is a book of symbols, and we have to make sure that we interpret these symbols figuratively. So, what is the point of this? Well, the point is this is something that's going to be decisive, it's going to be sudden, and it's going to be sure. So, the two main things is this is something that's certain, and then also notice what's the point. For strong is the Lord God. So, even though Rome was the greatest empire of its time, it is a city that conquered the world, but yet it's not strong enough to overcome God. It's not strong enough to conquer Him. And in fact, He is the one who is strong, and He's the one who's going to overturn the one who overturned everyone else. So this is the main point of this, and we'll talk about this a little bit more at the end of the chapter. So we'll just leave it at that for now. All right, so we have this great fall of Babylon, and the next thing that we're going to see is basically the reaction of three different groups who react to the fall of Babylon. So at this point in the timeline, Babylon has fallen, and we're looking simply at the reaction. And I think this fits well with the warning that we saw from Jesus earlier, to come out of her, my people. These are the ones who did not come out. And as a consequence, they suffered great loss. And so now we're going to see the loss that they suffered. So this emphasizes, I think, a couple of things. One, the nature of these people. And then it also adds warning to the fact that what's going to happen if we don't heed that warning to come out and to separate ourselves. So we're going to see God's justice emphasized as these three groups are affected by this. And then later, we're going to have these three groups who are contrasted with four groups in heaven. And we're going to look at the comparison between these two sets. All right, so let's look at the first one, the kings of the earth. Why did they mourn over Babylon's fall? Yes, there's some access to luxury and to power. Remember the horns that we talked about before, who shared for 1 hour and the power of the beast, and they hoped to have that. They had some measure of a power and authority associated with that. But when Rome falls, when the empire begins to fall apart, then their authority begins to fall apart as well. And then all the luxury that they commanded as a result of that also begins to fall apart. So verses 9 through 10 says, the kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her. All right, so they were seduced by her and shared in her sins. When they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. All right, so we've seen this term 1 hour before. Those who hope to share with the beast and its authority, its power, they had so for 1 hour. And in the same way, this brief period of time, in 1 hour the judgment has also come. All right, so Rome provided both sinful pleasure and decadent luxury for the kings of the earth, which they've now lost this, and as a consequence, they are mourning this. This is a personal loss to them. All right, and I want you to think about not only the wealth and the extravagance and the decadent luxury, but what went hand in hand with that. We have the games and the Colosseums. We have the Christians being martyred and persecuted. These things are inseparable in Rome. She offers one, but she has the other in her other hand. There was no way to really separate the two. And so these kings became participants and fellow workers in the persecution of the saints to have access to the luxury. And now this judgment comes upon them and they lose access to this luxury. All right, the other thing to keep in mind is because this is sudden, there's no way for them to reallocate their investments. There's no way for them to see this coming and say, oh, I'm going to pull all my stock out of Rome and I'm going to put it over here. There's no preparation time. There's no way for them to react. So this is a sudden loss for them. There's no way they can avoid it. And also notice, this is a very selfish mourning. And it's already said this, but this goes hand in hand with what we saw earlier about the horns of the beast. They would hate her and they would love her all at the same time. All right, we previously looked at the fact that they would hate her, that they would devour her and eat her flesh. So we see the fact that there is this internal turmoil and there's this love-hate relationship with the kings and the petty kings and those that are ruled by Rome. On one hand, they love what they get, but on the other hand, they hate the fact that they are kind of being subjected to her rule and to her authority and various things about this. And at the end of the day, these are purely just selfish people, and they're mourning their loss, what they suffer because of Rome's fall. All right, any questions or comments? All right, so a very similar pattern. Why are the merchants of the earth upset at the fall of Babylon?
She was one of their trading partners, and they lost a lot of money and investment.
Yes, and she was essentially the trading partner, all right? The merchants were also extremely wealthy, and it was because of all of the trade that was going back and forth to Rome. Not just the resources, but also slaves and many other things that are associated with Babylon, or in this case, Rome. So notice the description here. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron, and marble, and cinnamon and incense, fragrant oil and frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, and bodies and souls of men. So an indication of the slavery trade. The fruit that your soul longed for has gone from you, and all the things which are rich and splendid have gone from you, and you shall find them no more at all. The merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, saying, alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. So we have a reference back to the great harlot's clothing that we saw back in chapter 17. Her covering up her true nature and then also showing off her great wealth and her royalty. She's clothed not just in scarlet, but also in purple. That's the color of the kings. So this was someone who was both extremely wealthy and also royalty as well. And then why all the different things that are mentioned here, just for the point of emphasis, about how wealthy she was, and then how much trade and opportunity that these merchants enjoyed through her. And so all the things that were being sold that are wonderful, and at the same time, these are things that are no more. This is something that's going to disappear from the city, and as it loses its power and loses its wealth, it can't buy these things anymore. Had all these things, and now it's going to go without. So very reminiscent of passages in Isaiah and Jeremiah that talk about ancient Babylon being someone that's brought to the dust, and her skirt being raised, and having to work at the millstone, and being forced to do hard work and hard labor, even though previously she had been someone who enjoyed great wealth. So notice, what is the character of these people? Are these noble people? Are they upset that there's some kind of great injustice? No, they're just sorry that they've lost wealth. All right. This is their connection to the city, and this is all they really cared about. So there's no great loyalty here. All right. Why did the ship owners and sailors mourn her fall? This is our third group. What did they say?
They became rich by her tomb.
All right. So much of the same that we've seen with the other ones. They've also become very rich by her. Every shipmaster, all who traveled by ship, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, "What is like this great city?" They threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing, and saying, "Alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she is made desolate." Okay, again, the emphasis on the suddenness is something that happens in 1 minute. In 1 hour. And notice the exact same mourning and the same reasoning that's behind the kings and behind the merchants. What are they upset about? They're upset about the fact that they're not going to be rich anymore. That's the only thing that concerns them. Now, again, think about what they would have had to have fellowshipped to partake in all of this trade and all of this wealth. Everything that this city did to Christians, this would have been something they would have essentially fellowshipped and in building these relationships. There's no concern for that. There's no worry about that. There's only one thing that's on their mind. I'm not going to be rich anymore. And that's the only thing that matters to these people. Now, what did these three parties do to defend her or prevent her fall? Absolutely nothing. Look at how it describes each of these. The kings of the earth standing at a distance for fear of her torment. The merchants of the earth will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing. Every shipmaster, all who travel by ships, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out. These are people that, as we said, benefited and took pleasure in Rome, but at the end of the day, there's no true loyalty here. There's no real commitment. There's nothing in them that's built on spirit or principle or anything like that. These are very much fair-weather friends, and as soon as she gets in trouble, then they're hands off. They're way at a distance, and they're not going to get caught in the punishment that's happening to her. All right, so they're not loyal, and then also at the same time, again, all of these things that were allies to her that could have helped her, the reason they're not getting involved is because they know it wouldn't make a difference. They couldn't do anything to stop what's happening to her. So not only does this show us their character, but it also shows the fact that even with all these allies put together, Rome can't stop what's going to happen to her. All right? So, I think this understanding this helps us to take the long view in all of our relationships that we have to deal with and the loyalties that we have. In 2 Peter 3, 10 through 14, Peter talks about the destruction of the world. And he says, knowing this, what kind of people or what manner of people ought you to be? And so the question is I think, very similar to the one that Jesus brings out in Luke 12, 13 through 21. If we're going to perish like the rich person suddenly, then what is the point of building up all of our investments in this world and sinking everything we have into whether it's wealth or luxury or reputation or standing or whatever this world has to offer? What's the point of investing in it? What are we going to get from it? Because it's going to be destroyed. Ultimately, these people had made Rome their god. And so when Rome fell, their god fell. And they lost everything. They lost everything that they had invested in. And their life was essentially over. They were brought to complete ruin. So will we be like those people? Or are we going to put our investments in heaven? Think about Jesus in Matthew 6, 19 through 34. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be. And to cannot serve two masters and to lay up treasures and be rich in treasure towards heaven. And then before I leave this, I want to make mention of Luke 15, 13 through 16. What happened to the prodigal son who had all this great wealth? He went into the far country. He was throwing it around, throwing parties. What happened to his friends when the famine hit?
They left him.
Yeah, they left him high and dry. And where did he end up? All these people he took care of, and they had great big parties and great fun. Where did he end up? He was with the pigs, and he was just wishing he could eat the food that the pigs had. All right, so the friends, the loyalty, these pleasures that we think we buy, that we get with the world, they're not loyal, all right? They're just there for the party. And once the party's over, they're gone. So again, I think understanding this helps us to take the long view, to put investments in places where they will last in heaven, but also in relationships that will last, that are true, that will stand with us no matter what. So I think there's a very powerful lesson in here for us. All right, any other comments or questions about this? How so?
I hadn't noticed. Standing at a distance to will stand to stood. There are all three different tenses used.
I had not noticed that before, so I certainly hadn't thought about it. So if there's significance to it, I don't know what it is. So do you have any ideas?
No, I just noticed it once you put them up.
Yeah, it's a good thought. The King's interesting. It's not progressive. I mean, you have standing, so it's essentially a present tense, and then you have future, will stand, and then they stood, past. So present, future, past. I don't know. It's not a progression that makes sense to me. So I don't know. It's a good idea. Something to think about. Good observation. Any other thoughts or comments? All right. So, how are God's people contrasted with these three parties here in this chapter? What are they told to do?
Rejoice.
All right. So we have these three parties. They're in tremendous mourning. And again, this is not like just like, oh, I'm sorry to see this. I mean, they're throwing dust on their heads. They're wailing. They're crying. I mean, they are truly distraught. And yet God's people are told to rejoice over her, O heaven, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her. And in her was found the blood of prophets and saints and of all who were slain on the earth. All right, so because these people came out, because they were faithful unto death, as we talked about in chapter 12, 11, they don't suffer the loss that all of these other three parties suffer because their God has fallen. So instead, they can take joy in the reckoning and restoration of justice. Now, notice this is not like, well, you hurt me and you got hurt back, so I feel better. This is not revenge. This is an avenging. This is something that was wrong, terribly wrong with the world, and was not being resolved. And after crying and crying, how long, God has finally acted. Justice is restored. This is a reckoning. So the joy comes not so much from a personal satisfaction of, I have personally been revenged, but in avenging in the sense that this has been a terrible unrighteousness, a terrible miscarriage of justice, and it is now being restored, it is being reckoned. We're seeing good triumphing over evil, and it's that joy that's associated with this. All right. So as we said before, as the capital of the world empire, the city of Rome was responsible for the murder of saints committed through the empire, tying the harlot closely to the beast. Why do we say that? There's kind of a curious statement here in verse 24. And in her was found the blood of prophets and saints and of all who were slain on the earth. Did all the prophets and apostles, were they killed in Rome? No, not literally. But Rome was responsible. She was the head. She was the capital. What was happening in her provinces was her responsibility. It was happening at her direction, at her seduction, at her influence. So as a consequence, she's responsible. And it's the same as if they had all been literally shed within her borders, because they were within the borders of her influence and of her authority and therefore responsibility. And then also notice this is tying very closely what's happening in the harlot with what's happening in the beast. Whatever the beast was doing, the harlot's responsible for. So this is somebody who again, I think this goes back to the fact this is definitely Rome, the capital of the Roman Empire, because this is somebody who is responsible for what's happening in the beast, not somebody who's subject to it like Jerusalem would be. All right, any other thoughts or comments or questions? All right. So, a great fall, suddenly and entirely. So, we see this angel who picks up a millstone and throws it into the sea. What is the significance of this angel throwing the millstone into the sea?
The angel here says this is how Babylon will be. Mm-hmm. And we learn from other passages, millstones, and just from history, millstones aren't going to float. So Babylon the Great is going to sink, it's going to fall.
Mm-hmm. And generally, how big are millstones? Are we talking like little pebbles, handheld size? We're talking something that's multiple feet, up to 7 feet or more. And you think about Samson being behind the millstone and pushing it. This is something that normally you would tie horses or cows or oxen to. These would be huge things that nobody just by themselves is going to pick up. So we have a very impressive being who's picking up this millstone, throwing it into the sea. Given a millstone of that size, what's going to happen when it gets chunked into the water? It's going to sink. What else is going to happen? It's going to be a lot of waves, and it's going to be quite spectacular and quite graphic. So this is something where we kind of read over the words very quickly, but if you work out a little bit and you picture it, you see something that's very dramatic. And therein lies the one of the two points, that this is something that's going to be very dramatic when it happens, and I think that's one of the things he's saying here. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, "Thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found anymore." So there's our two points. This is going to be spectacular. This is going to be a violent thing. And then also, it's going to sink and it's not going to be found anymore. So a giant splash graphically depicting the violence associated with Rome's destruction. It's going to have tremendous impact. It's going to be something that's going to be seen from everywhere. And it's going to be something that's going to impact a lot of people. As Morgan said, there's going to be waves associated with this. And we've seen that already in this chapter, looking at these very wealthy and powerful classes who are going to be badly damaged and affected by this. And then finally, as this thing sinks, it's not going to float back to the top. It's not going to come back later. It's gone. All right. So there's going to be a complete absence of Rome after its destruction. Now, as we're looking at these things, this ought to be forming a question as you're trying to reconcile this with history. But we're going to get to that here in just a second. So, as we said, this emphasizes the tremendous loss and irreversible nature of Rome's destruction, which again emphasizes the warning that we looked at previously to come out, and that God's justice is going to be reckoned on her tremendous wickedness. So emphasizes both the importance and the need to come out of this, because this is going to be really bad and you don't want to be associated with it. And then because it's so bad, it's a reflection on how bad she was. All right. So how is Babylon described after its fall? We have the millstone, and then what other description is given?
Basically, there's nothing anymore. The music no longer plays. There's no longer craftsmen. The light's gone out, the voice of the bride and the bride are no longer heard.
Yep, so everything that is a cause for joy and for happiness and for laughter, all of these things are gone. For progress, construction, all of this is gone. So the sound of harpists, musicians, flutists, and trumpeters shall not be heard in you anymore. No craftsman of any craft shall be found in you anymore. And the sound of a millstone shall not be heard in you anymore. The light of a lamp shall not shine in you anymore, and the voice of a bridegroom and bride shall not be heard in you anymore. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, for by your sorcery all the nations were deceived. So here's the cause again, continuously being emphasized to us. There is a reason for this great destruction. It was because her wickedness was equally great. All right. So these things disappear, indicating removal of everything that makes for joy and happiness, construction, progress, etc. And it's emphasizing the destruction and the ruin of the city. Why is this happening? As we said, it's a result of the decadent lust and immorality that they peddle throughout the world. All right, now, the entire city of Rome was never burned to the ground. Furthermore, if you look around today, Rome is still there. There's still trade, there's still commerce. Pretty sure people are getting married in Rome today, and there's still business and there's still construction. Now, one of the things, if I remember correctly, the Flavian dynasty promoted was that Rome was the eternal city. And even still today, it's known as that. So how do we reconcile these awesome symbols with the fact that Rome was never completely destroyed and that it's still there even today?
It's representing here Rome as a whole, this wicked city of Rome, this great power is destroyed. What was this great power of the harlot is no more.
All right, very good, Micah. So, if we think about this, there's a few points. First of all, Rome did suffer very tremendous damage to the city and to the population and to the physical loss. There's three different occasions where Rome was sacked. 410, 455, and 546 AD. So in most of these cases, most of the city was destroyed. And afterwards, population was always cut at least in half, if not more. And most of the things were destroyed that were of value. In these cases, the people who were coming in to rob, to steal, and to plunder. So most of the wealth was being exported as well. So two things to keep in mind there. Now, I want to build on these. First of all, notice, what do these plagues ultimately target? They're not targeting the buildings. Our mind's jumping to, I want to see the buildings wiped out. But the plagues are actually targeting the people. It's the people who are being afflicted, not the buildings of Rome. So based on this, it's really important to understand that this harlot, the great city, if you will, represents the people of Rome, just like the church. When we talk about the church, what are we talking about? Are we talking about these four walls? No, we're talking about us. If someone attacks the church, are they burning down our buildings? Well, they might, but really, what are we talking about? We're talking about the people being attacked. In the same way, we have the same symbol or figure of speech being used for Rome itself, that it's actually the people that are being destroyed. So not just the people, but as we said before, and this is the reason why I've been emphasizing this in earlier lessons, if you will, the dream of Rome, the allure of Rome, the reputation of Rome. When she gets sacked and her wealth is carried away, this great empire, what does she have to offer now as far as strength? Nothing. She can't even defend herself. So how can she say, come be a part of my empire. I will take care of you. I will offer you these things. How can she say, come share in our wealth when her wealth is gone? She is being shattered both as the actual wealth and the security, but also her gods. Can she say, come worship our gods? They take care of us, so they'll take care of you. She can't say that anymore. So everything that's associated with her allure, with her influence, with her power, with her wealth, it's shattered. It's broken. And so, yes, there is a great physical loss, and the city was just almost entirely wiped out, and most of the people destroyed. But even the thing that was for sure destroyed was the great influence, this great harlot that was having control over the people of the earth. That influence and that power and that seduction was gone. And now we have, like God talked about ancient Babylon, where he said he would pull up her skirt and reveal her nakedness. Now she is exposed for who she is, and she has no more power, and she has no more influence, and she has no more charm. And so what we see is this pagan, blasphemous, persecuting city of John's day. Those people and their influence was destroyed. That was wiped out. All right, so this was utterly destroyed, even if not every building was burned to the ground. Thoughts or comments? Questions? All right, I think this is, as you become more and more familiar with history, this is one of the more important questions as you try to reconcile this with Rome. And I think understanding this is one of the most important keys to actually reconciling that and finding harmony there. All right, now let's go into chapter 19 and let's talk about the marriage feast. Now, we've been told what heaven or what people are supposed to do, the apostles and the prophets and those here on earth. Now, let's see the reaction actually kind of play out, if you will. So as we go into chapter 19, who is praising the Lord and why? Let's focus on the who first. All right, we're going to have four groups. So we had three groups that were mourning her fall. Now we have four groups that are going to be rejoicing over her fall. All right, so we have a great multitude in heaven. Who else?
24 elders.
24 elders. Who else? All right, the four living creatures. So go back to the throne scene back in chapter 4. We're seeing that same scene, and we're seeing the reaction there from the four living creatures and from the 24 elders. And then we have this great multitude. And then who else do we have? We have a voice coming from the throne. And then what looks like maybe a fifth thing, but it seems to be basically the chorus of everything else put together. We have this sound of a great multitude. It's the sound of many waters and the sound of mighty thunderings. So notice what we have. All four of these, we have these alleluias. All right, this is our word for hallelujah, which comes from two Hebrew words, hallel, which means to praise. And it's where, if you've ever seen the musical group Hallel, that's what they're coming from, the idea of praising God. And then Yah, which is short for Jehovah. All right, so this is saying praise God in the Hebrew. And here we have it transliterated into the Greek. So this is a word that, if I remember correctly, it occurs 10 times in the New Testament, and 9 out of the 10 times are in Revelation. Mostly this is something you see associated with the Psalms and with the praise that they give to God. So we have something that's very much akin to the Psalms here in Revelation, in this praise, this thanksgiving that's being given to God here. All right, so we have essentially the whole host of heaven. All right, this voice from the throne, it could be the voice of Jesus, but it's really anonymous. He says, praise our God, which seems a little strange. You would say, well, Jesus would never say that, but he referenced God as being his God in John 20:17. It's pointless to debate and discuss it because the voice here is anonymous and there's no way to know for sure. But anyway, we have essentially all the host of heaven who are praising God and giving thanks. Now, in general, why are they doing this? All right. So, whereas previously we've seen the harlot's fall being mourned, now we see her rejoicing, so it stands a very stark contrast. And I want to notice a couple of things. God's judging the great harlot, and her smoke rises up forever and ever. So if her smoke's going up forever and ever, can she come back?
No.
This is lasting destruction. There is no Rome revived. There's no way that she's coming back. She can't overturn her judgment, and she can't return. This is the end of Rome. And you'll see this exact phrase being used to the other enemies of God as we go throughout the remainder of the book. They're all going to suffer this fate. And here we see Rome, her smoke rising up forever and ever. We foresaw this in chapter 14, verses 9 through 11. And here we see it actually playing out and being passed at this point in the timeline of Revelation. All right, so how is God described in this context? And how does the judgment of the harlot reflect this?
Righteous.
All right, and several things are described here. True and righteous. All right, so he is just, he is righteous in his judgment. He is upholding the righteous, and he's throwing down the wicked. And then what about the true? Well, what he said he was going to do is true. He's been faithful and true to his word. What he promised and foretold is coming to pass. All right, what else?
Mm-hmm.
All right, very good. So we see him as being omnipotent, as being all-powerful, almighty God. All right, notice the things that they ascribe to him. Salvation, glory, and honor, and power belong to the Lord our God. Are these people taking credit for what happened? No. They've put all their trust in him. He has been true to his word and come through with what he's promised. And so now they're giving thanks to him. They're recognizing him. All right. He is righteous and just. Why? Because we've seen him judge the great harlot. She did all these terrible things. She corrupted the earth with her fornication. And then she shed the blood of his servants. So God has avenged them on her, and he has judged her. And notice that he says, at the last, the Lord God, omnipotent reigns. So this is parallel to the praise that we saw earlier, that God has taken the throne and that he's reigned, that we see this in actuality here, that he has seized control, he has decapitated Rome, and he is taking over and he is reigning and wielding the power in actuality that has always belonged to him. So emphasizing that he's all-powerful and that he's also righteous. We see both of these qualities being played out here. All right, now let's talk about the preparation for the marriage feast. I really would like to be able to finish this one. Let's talk about Jewish wedding customs. Verses 7 through 9 says, "Let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and his wife has made herself ready. And to her it was granted to be arrayed in fine linen, clean and bright, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. Then he said to me, 'Write, blessed are those who are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb.' And he said to me, 'These are the true sayings of God.'" All right, anybody tell me about the phases of the marriage feast in Jewish times? We're not talking about modern English times.
Mm-hmm. And the preparation and the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And with the betrothal, he would come and propose and give her the gift. And then he'd go away and prepare a room for her. And she would prepare herself until the unknown arrival. And then at the unknown arrival, they'd have the honeymoon. And then after that was the wedding feast.
All right. Very good. So a few things. I've seen what Sarah Beth said it lines up very well with what I said. We're going to walk through these maybe in slightly more general terms. So first of all, we have this contract. So either the groom or oftentimes the father comes and negotiates for the bride. If I can have her, then I will pay this. So there is a bride price that is set. And you see this very early, even in Genesis, with Abraham sending his servant for Rebekah, but then also Jacob lobbying for Rachel and for Leah ultimately as well. And then the men of Shechem also doing a similar thing for Dinah, for Shechem's son to marry her. So we set up this contract. There's an agreement that's arranged. At this point, we have the betrothal. Now, this is very different from our modern engagement. First of all, at this point, the only way to break it off is a divorce. And they are considered man and wife at this point, even though they are not coming together. They're still living separately. And as Sarah Beth said, the husband is preparing a place, and the wife is preparing herself. I'll run through the last pieces real quick. Matthew 1:18-20, remember Joseph was betrothed to Mary, and then when he saw she was with child, he was going to put her away, even though they had not come together. So another example of that. Then we have the procession, where the groom comes at an unknown time for his bride from the father's house. We have the parable in Matthew 25 where we go through this. And then there's a big celebration feast. And then finally they're come together. And I found two different sources that would flip those two. Sometimes people say the feast comes before the cohabitation, or some people say the cohabitation comes and then there's the feast. And there's intricacies in the details there. But those are the last two events. All right, we will stop here and we will pick up with the wedding feast next time, and then we'll get into the Battle of Armageddon. All right, thank you guys.